This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Sam Brigger. Terry has our first interview. I'll let her introduce it.
My guest, Colson Whitehead, won Pulitzer Prizes for two consecutive novels. The first Pulitzer was for The Underground Railroad, an allegory about race in America told through the stories of an escaped slave and a slave catcher. It was adapted into an Amazon series. The second Pulitzer was for The Nickel Boys, based on the true story of a segregated state reform school for boys, in which the boys were physically abused and dozens died. A film adaptation starring Anjanou Ellis is in the works. After writing about those grim subjects, Whitehead started writing crime novels, set in Harlem. These novels give him the chance to write snappy dialogue laced with witty observations while writing about class and race, as well as crime and corruption at every level, from petty criminals to cops, city politicians, and Harlem's elite. Harlem Shuffle, the first novel in his projected Harlem trilogy, was set in the 60s. The new novel, Crook Manifesto, takes place from 1971 to 76. It brings back the main character, Ray Carney, the owner of a furniture store on 125th Street in Harlem, who takes pride in upgrading his customers' living rooms with comfortable, quality sofas and recliners. But it's the money he's earned from fencing stolen goods that's enabled him to move from a cramped apartment to the home he owns on Harlem's Driver's Row. Fencing got him deeper into crime than he was prepared for. In the opening of Crook Manifesto, he's been retired from crime for 4 years, but when his daughter insists that she needs tickets to the Jackson 5 concert, but they're sold out, he goes to the person he's confident can get him a pair, a corrupt white cop. By asking for a favor, Carney is forced to perform one in return, which leads him to become the unwitting accomplice to a murder. The novel's characters include a leader of the revolutionary group, the Black Liberation Army, the producer of a blaxploitation film, and a groundbreaking comic who seems based on Richard Pryor. Sirens from police cars and fire trucks are the background noise throughout the book. Colson Whitehead, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you back again, and I'm so glad you wrote a sequel to Harlem Shuffle, because it's really such an enjoyable series. So I want to start by asking you to read a section from the first chapter of the book. Just to set it up, why don't you explain the scene? Set the scene for us.
Sure. It's the opening of the book, 1971, and Ray Carney, our furniture store owner slash part-time fence, is having a normal day of business, which means there's a lot of noise and crazy activity outside on 125th Street in Harlem. He has a sales assistant named Larry who is trying to reel in a customer named Mr. Foster. Another siren. Business, orderly business, unfolded inside the walls of Carney's furniture, but out on the street, it was Harlem rules. Rowdy, unpredictable, more trifling than a loser uncle. The sirens zipped up and down the Avs as regularly as subway trains, all hours. Per Calamity's timetable, if not the cops on the mayhem mission, then an ambulance racing to unwind fate, a fire engine speeding to a vacant tenement before the blaze ate the whole block, or en route to a six-story building kerosene for the insurance, a dozen families inside. Carney's father had torched a building or two in his day. It paid the rent. This was a radio car siren. Carney joined Larry and Charlie Foster at the window. On the other side of 125th, two white officers hassled a young man in a dark denim jacket and red flared trousers, their vehicle beached on the sidewalk. The cops pushed him up against the window of Hutchins Tobacco, known for its cigarettes without tax stamps and for its vermin problem. The 125th Street foot traffic bent around this obstruction in the stream. Most did not stop. Nothing special about a roust. If not here, somewhere else. But the manhunt had people edgy and off their routines. They lingered and muttered to one another, sassing and heckling the policemen, even as they remained at a distance that testified to their fear. The taller cop swept the man's feet apart and patted the inside of his legs. "What'd he do?" Carney said. "They pulled up, tackled him like he robbed a bank," Larry said. "Acting crazy," Charlie Foster said, "looking for those Black Panthers." Black Liberation Army, Larry said. Same thing. Carney didn't want to interrupt when there was a fish on the line, but the disagreement between the Panthers and the offshoot Black Liberation Army was about more than names. The philosophical dispute encompassed the temperament of the street, law enforcement's current posture vis-a-vis Harlem, and all the sirens. Step back, and maybe it contained everything.
That's Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Crook Manifesto. It's interesting that you get in, like, the Panthers versus the Black Liberation Army, like, by page 9. And the impression I get, you know, from that passage is that the Panthers and the BLA, they're making headlines. But to the people in Harlem and the people who work at Ray Carney's store and to Ray Carney himself, it's confusing what the difference is. And their revolutionary politics isn't meaning very much to the people in Ray's world.
Yeah, I mean, it's 1970, 1971, and there's this rift in the Black Panther Party. How do we actually get things done? Can we work within the American system, or do we want revolution? And so the Black Liberation Army has splintered off. They're robbing banks, allegedly. They're taking credit for shooting at policemen. And there's a manhunt sort of disturbing the rhythm of people's lives. What's going on? Why are all these policemen sort of cruising around our neighborhood even more than usual? And it's in this moment of rupture that I pick up Carney's story a couple years after the first book, Harlem Shuffle, and he has to navigate this mess.
Why did you want to pick it up there?
I had a system where the first book would be about the 60s and the second about the 70s, and I'm trying to find moments that of opportunity, you know, for storytelling that speak to Carney's dilemma in this world. What's next for him? Which way is he going to jump? The same way the Panthers are at this moment of inflection. Where's the city going? Crime is at an all-time high. We're looking down at a fiscal crisis that's coming down the pike. So New York is in this place of change as well. And so I picked 1971, 1973, and 1976 because each offers a different sort of opportunity to drop Carney and his supporting cast in a different place.
The Black Liberation Army in your novel is in with some corrupt cops in terms of expropriating money from businesses and banks. So were they together in the real world, the members of the Black Liberation Party and corrupt cops who were willing to steal money or get payoffs in order to do what they wanted to do?
Well, they're incredibly corrupt cops in New York in 1971. It's the year of the Knapp Commission, a big police corruption investigation that people might have heard of through Serpico. Is there a documented link between police in real life and the Black Liberation Army? I invented it. I think at different points in the lives of different cities like New York and Los Angeles, you do get that sort of more direct collusion. The crime in this book, that Detective Munson, the sort of white corrupt cop, is engaged in is invented, as far as I know.
Do you feel like you're smearing the BLA by doing that?
They're sort of cagey about what they were up to in the early 70s, even still, even after they've, you know, some of them have fled to Cuba or served their prison sentences. So I'll let them sort of speak for themselves.
You were born in 1969. The book begins in 1970, and it ends in 1976. So, like, you're 7 maybe by the time the book ends. What are some of the things you actually remember going on in the background when you were that young that you put in the book, and things that you just missed out on that you wanted to know more about that you put in the book?
Yeah, I'm barely in the book. My early 70s New York is dingy and grimy, and so I mostly remember the streets and the kind of desperation, you know, crimes at this fever pitch, and you never knew what was going to happen when you walked out the door. So I think that I definitely absorbed that sense of paranoia and fear.
Since the Panthers and the Black Liberation Army figure into your novel, what was your introduction to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably in in a very cheesy way, like on bad TV shows, like Good Times or The White Shadow. I think, you know, I was coming of age in the late 70s and consuming TV and movies. And that was like, you know, plenty of time for the revolutionary fervor, black national thought, the late 60s, early 70s to trickle into, you know, pop culture. So it's somebody on a sitcom and their dashiki-clad uncle who's very militant and walking into this very sort of bourgeois household. So it's through pop culture. And obviously, the history of the Black Panther Party was not being taught in my high school. I assume most high schools. And now it's, you know, I think illegal to teach black history in certain states and cities. So it wasn't until college I, you know, got sort of more grounding on some of the real arguments and what different aspects of the civil rights movement actually meant and what they did.
Was your family involved in any aspect of the civil rights or post-civil rights era?
Yeah, I love, you know, hearing the story about my mom and dad going to the March on Washington. They weren't activists. They were people trying to raise a family in an incredibly racist country and finding their own way of changing things, changing the status quo, which was, you know, I think family and their business.
So growing up seeing the Panthers as described in sitcoms or The White Shadow, did you not take them seriously or did they seem foolish because of their portrayal on sitcoms? Was that your first impression?
Well, no, I think there's this, you know, they were holy. The rift that I describe in Harlem Shuffle between people who are more revolutionary oriented versus reformist was not part of, you know, that those sort of pop cultural depictions. But in the way that my parents would talk about that time, my friends' parents, it was very serious. It was deadly serious. No matter what you thought they ended up achieving or what their legacy was in 1982, 1984, 1985, they were, you know, these holy warriors.
You've said in an interview that you retreated into pop culture in part to escape your father's alcohol-fueled rages. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is that too personal?
It is a bit personal, but I think, you know, being able to close my door and retreat into these imaginary worlds, whether it was, you know, whether I was 7 years old or 8 years old, and thinking about what the war against the Empire would be like, you know, if I was in it, or Star Trek, or Spider-Man, or even trying to outrun zombies in Night of the Living Dead. You know, I think the imaginary worlds of all these different writers I adored provided escape, you know, the same way that, you know, people have always, you know, found release and escape and nurturing in storytelling and in fantasy.
One of your novels, Sag Harbor, is inspired by the summers you spent in Sag Harbor. Can you describe Sag Harbor and its significance in your life?
Sag Harbor is a town on the east end of Long Island, sort of better known as the Hamptons. And there's a town in that Hamptons constellation called Sag Harbor. It was an old whaling town. And there's a longstanding Black and Native American neighborhood about, you know, 3/4 of a mile outside town. And Black folks from New Jersey and New York started vacationing there in the 30s and 40s. And this little community sprouted it up by word of mouth. And my family started going there in the 40s. I spent all my summers there until I went to college. And it was this neat little community nestled in this improbable place. And there are other places like it in, you know, I hear people talk about how it reminded them of their childhood in Michigan, another sort of Black town, Black beach community, or in Baltimore. And I had to sort of shake up my writing career. I had to find a new way of telling stories. And so I picked this really autobiographical story to tell about growing up in the 1980s. And, you know, it changed how I approach characters and writing, and so it's not only a place that sort of formed my identity in many different ways, but also, you know, who I am as a writer in the last 15 years.
In the novel, the main character has a brother who's, I don't know, like 10 months apart in age, something like that. And so it's as if they were twins when they're very young and they go their separate ways. Did you have a sibling who was that close in age to you?
Yeah, my brother, who passed away a couple years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
We were 10 months apart, and everyone thought that we were twins because we were a little unit, sort of inseparable. And, you know, part of the book is capturing the beauty of that twinhood. And then also the separation that happened when we became teenagers and we had to sort of, you know, find our different paths in high school and in the world. So I'm writing about that time, but also a time in my life that was, you know, very, very formative.
Did you like having somebody, like having a brother who was so close in age to you that people thought you were twins?
You know, now it's, yeah, we broke up in high school. But it was very, you know, it was a very, very special thing. You know, we did everything together, whether it was, you know, reading Fangoria magazine and reading out part of John Carpenter's interview about Escape from New York and The Fog, or in Halloween, his movie Halloween, or renting David Cronenberg movies by the armful from Crazy Eddie's, which was an electronics store in New York City. So, yes, I mean, it was, you know, I hope I did some justice in getting him into the book and telling our story.
Was your breakup acrimonious?
Yeah, I mean, it was, in high school, I think the burden of being a semi-respectable teenager was a bit much for us. You know, I think we all had to, we each had to find our own different way of being out in the world. So, we were close, but never as close as we were before the high-stakes game of puberty started.
Did your brother's death make you think about your own mortality?
My brother, you know, was in a sort of bad health for many years, and definitely in the Nickel Boys and Harlem Shuffle, I was trying to figure out that relationship. Both those novels have, you know, black men who are very close and go in different directions. One person makes it out. One person does not make it out. One person finds their way in the world and the other doesn't. And so even though those books don't necessarily seem to have a very sort of autobiographical element, in those two core relationships, you know, I was definitely trying to figure out me, figure out my brother, and how we ended up splitting apart after being twins.
So, well, we've been talking about the 70s. Has your head really been in the 80s because you're working on that new novel now?
I'm trying to figure out what of the 80s will work for Carney and his gang. So New York has come out of the fiscal crisis. Wall Street's booming again. And we're getting that, you know, boom and bust action in terms of the city's fortune and Carney's fortune. They're mirroring each other. So what do I use from the glitzy 80s? You know, Donald Trump, no. You know, I'm not going to befoul my book with Donald Trump. So,
he's not going to read it. If he's not in it, you know, he's not going to read it. You've just lost one reader.
So it was New York in 1981, fruitful territory, 1984, 1986, 87. New York does, you know, find its footing financially. And then in the late 80s, the AIDS crisis, the crack epidemic is sort of waiting to spoil the party again. And that's, you know, that's definitely the city I know. It's going through a bad period, being laid low, and then trying to figure out how to come back from it. So I'm trying to figure out what moments in 80s New York will serve the story and also are interesting to me. I, you know, sort of found my identity in alternative music, college radio, as we used to call it. Carney's probably not hanging out at CBGB's. He's probably not doing the things I used to do. So I have to figure out what a 50-something Carney is going to seek out and interact with.
Just one more thing. I know that you've said that when you walk around outside, you often have like an expressionless face or you look sad because you're thinking. And I think people ask you like, what's wrong?
Sure. Yeah.
That always used to happen to me when I was growing up. Like people would come up to you and say, oh, honey, what's wrong? Are you lost? What's your reaction when people do that to you? Do they still?
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, I was thinking about death or something.
I wish I'd thought of that. I'll remember that the next time if somebody does that to me.
Yeah, there you go.
Colson, thank you so much.
Sure. Take care. Thanks a lot.
Colson Whitehead's new novel is Crook Manifesto. He spoke with Terry Gross. In the novel All the Sinners Bleed by our next guest, S.A. Cosby, Sheriff Titus Crown is tracking down a serial killer, terrorizing his jurisdiction, Charon County, a fictional county in southeast Virginia. The killer's victims are black children. As he investigates, Titus unravels the racial and religious animus behind the killings. Titus had left Charon County to go to college and to work with the FBI investigating domestic terrorism. But after that career abruptly ended, he reluctantly returned to live with his aging father. Titus was elected the first black sheriff of Charon, a remarkable achievement considering the prevalence of Confederate flags in the area, the high school named after Jefferson Davis, and a statue honoring the Confederate cause outside the courthouse. Titus has to figure out a way to keep the county safe from the serial killer and also keep simmering racial tensions from getting out of hand, especially as a white supremacist group is planning to march in support of what it calls, quote, Southern heritage. S.A. Cosby has written several crime novels, including the bestseller Razorblade Tears and Blacktop Wasteland. Razorblade Tears appeared on many Best of the Year lists in 2021. Cosby, whose first name is Sean, grew up in Matthews County, a place very much like the fictional Charon County, and now lives nearby. Well, Sean Cosby, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start with the prologue to your book, if you could do a reading for us. And this sort of sets up what Charon County is like and some of its history.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Charon County. Charon County was founded in bloodshed and darkness, literally and figuratively. Even the name is enveloped in shadows and morbidity. Legend has it that the name of the county was supposed to be Charlotte or Charles, but the town elders waited too late. Those names were already taken by the time they decided to incorporate their fledgling encampment. As the story goes, they just moved their finger down the list of names until they settled on Charon. Those men, weathered as wit leather, with hands like splitting mauls, bestowed the name on their new town with no regard to its macabre nature. Or perhaps they just liked the name because a river flowed through the county and emptied into the Chesapeake like the River Styx. Who knows? Who could know the thoughts of those long dead men? What is known is that in 1805, in the dead of night, a group of white landowners, chafing at the limits of their own manifest destiny, set fire to the last remaining indigenous village on the teardrop-shaped peninsula that would become Charon County. Those who escaped the flames were brought down by muskets with no regard to age, gender, or infirmity. That was the first of many tragedies in the history of Charon. There was the cannibalism of the winter of 1853, the malaria outbreak of 1901, the United Daughters of the Confederacy picnic poisoning of 1935, the Danforth family murder-suicide of 1957, the tent revival baptismal drownings of 1968, and on and on and on. The soil of Charon County, like most towns and counties in the South, was sown with a generation of tears.
That's S.A. Cosby reading from his new book, All the Sinners Bleed. So, Sean, I really thought that was interesting, the sort of idea that the county is founded in bloodshed and darkness, and that somehow that history has haunted the place or tainted it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Southerner born and bred. I was raised in Virginia. I was born in Matthews County. I've lived my whole life, you know, 30 miles from the former capital of the Confederacy. If there's a place that is more haunted by its past and more overwhelmed by its original sin than the South, I'm not aware of it. The South is, in many ways, is the birthplace of the country, but it's also a microcosm for what's wrong with the nation. And so I'm a big proponent of the idea that maybe the South isn't, you know, supernaturally haunted, but it is definitely haunted by the pain and the bloodshed and the violence that existed here.
Do you sort of see that haunting whenever you're walking around or driving around where you live?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can definitely feel it. You can feel it, you know. For years, our local elementary school was Lee Jackson School, named after Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And, you know,
one name wasn't enough.
Yeah, one Confederate statue, one Confederate soldier wasn't enough. We had to really hammer home the point of what we're trying to say here. And so, you know, as a kid, I went to school there. I was taught that the Civil War was the war of Northern aggression. I was taught that the Civil War wasn't technically, if you squint, about slavery. And so those are things that are still being taught to a certain extent in my hometown today. I think, you know, somebody said to me one time that the difference between the South and post-World War II Germany is that Germans are ashamed of their history and Southerners aren't ready to accept it. And I think that has a lot of validity.
We'll get to some of that a little bit later. But first, you know, I read that you originally set out to write a book about police brutality, but then you shifted and the hero of this book is actually a sheriff. What brought about that evolution?
So, and this book was really inspired by the murder of George Floyd and all the events of that summer. And I really wanted to take a book and talk about policing, but use it in, like I said before, the microcosm of a small town and sort of use that small town police force to reflect the issues and concerns about policing on a larger scale. And what I realized rather quickly is that I did not have enough wherewithal to write about that in a really, truly unbiased fashion. I'm too personally involved in it. I've been pulled over for driving while black before. I've had my face shoved in the asphalt for no reason, just because I was driving a nice car. And so there was a lot of emotion there that I wasn't able to pull back from. And when you write like that, I think you end up sermonizing. Nobody wants a 300-page sermon. You know, you want a good story. And so I set the book aside for a while, and I didn't think about it. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was a former minister. He's no longer practicing. And he said something that really struck me. He said, you know, the thing that bothered me the most is when I was a minister, I didn't feel like I actually was helping the least of us, the people who needed my help the most. And that sort of sparked this idea in me about a character who's trying to do that. I didn't want to write about it from the point of view of a minister, just because I felt like writing about the police and writing about a sheriff, I could sort of accomplish on a smaller scale the things I had originally set out to do. So I can talk about policing, but I can talk about religion. I can talk about sex. I can talk about class. You know, those are, in my opinion, the four pillars of Southern fiction, because Southern fiction is so intrinsically tied up with those issues, with religion, with sex, with class, you know, and those things are intrinsic in the work of Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor or Harry Cruz or Carson McCullers or Ernest J. Gaines. You see all of that all the time, and it's always in flux in their books. And so I decided I was going to try to write a book like that.
So as I mentioned earlier, Sean, in your book, there's a statue commemorating the Confederate cause. It stands in front of the courthouse. It's actually not even like a real person. It's just called Old Rebel Joe. And in the book, you write about like how this statue and others like it were erected in the South by this group, the United Daughters of the Confederacy. I was hoping you could read that passage for us about the history of these statues.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. Titus pulled out of the parking lot and slipped onto the road. Night had come and covered the sky above Cheyenne County like a black blanket full of pinpricks. He turned right and drove past the courthouse building. Ricky Sowers and his neo-Confederates had installed solar lights around the statue of Old Rebel Joe. Titus thought the lights looked cheap and disposable, much like the statue itself. It had been erected in 1923 by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, a part of a coordinated and extensive propaganda campaign to reframe traitors as patriots. After World War I, thousands of black veterans had returned home after saving democracy from the Kaiser with a renewed sense of dignity. They were heroes, after all. Why should they have to bow and scrape to anybody? Then the Red Summer happened, and white men, like Everett Cunningham, Scott's great-grandfather, made it their mission to remind these heroes of their place.
So, Sean, did you know about that history before researching for the book, or did you come across it then?
Yes and no. My grandfather, my great-grandfather was a World War I vet, so I knew a little bit about the Red Summer. As far as the Confederate statues, I had a little bit of that history, but I had found it much later in researching another book, and I was just fascinated by the idea that some, you know, 20, 30-odd years after the Civil War and after the history of the country was adjudicated, these folks took it upon themselves to reframe the Civil War. And I think that's a horrible, horrible thing that we're still dealing with today, that we are not able to accept the truth of our history, not just the Civil War, but of, you know, America's history in total. You know, the idea of America is this incredible, wonderful experiment in freedom and autonomy, but the way we got there is filled and littered with, you know, darkness and degradation. And I think we do ourselves a disservice if we're not honest about it. You know, it's funny. I'll hear a lot of people say, you know, we can't take these statues down. And these people were just people of their time. And, you know, they were fighting for what they thought was right. You know, and I'm like, yeah, and I'm sure Nazis thought they were right, too. That doesn't make it correct. I'll hear people sometimes, especially nowadays, you hear people say, oh, you're trying to make, you know, young white children feel guilty about what their ancestors did. Well, if they don't share those same sentiments, why would they feel guilty? You know, it's that maddening, you know, fallacy of logic that drives me crazy sometimes.
Yeah, knowing that the history of these statues, that they were part of this like propaganda campaign after World War One, like really to subjugate black people, like what does that do to the arguments that some make about how honoring the Confederacy or even displaying the Confederate flag is just a way to celebrate Southern heritage, that it's not tethered to the history of slavery or white supremacy?
I think that's an incredibly naive, if not outright disingenuous attitude. You can't separate those two. I am a Southerner. My Southern bona fides go back to 1867. My great-great-great-grandfather, Gabriel Cosby, and his brother Kit Cosby founded the church that I attended for a number of years. When you wave that Confederate flag and tell people that that's Southern heritage, what you're doing is erasing all the indigenous people that live in the South, all the black people that live in the South, the huge amount of Jewish Southerners that live in the South. What you're saying is that only one demographic's interpretation of history matters. And, you know, I am a proud Southerner. I have no intention of leaving. And every scrap of land or every pole that some good old boy erects to put a Confederate flag on, someone who looks like me has bled and died and lived there. And I have as much right to Southern heritage as anyone else. And so I don't plan on ceding one inch, one foot, one iota to someone who has this sort of reimagined revisionist idea of what the Civil War was.
There's a similar statue in Matthews County where you grew up. Is that still there or has that been taken down?
No, it's still there. We had there was a referendum on the election board a few years ago to take it down, and the folks who were in favor of it staying up were successful in wording the referendum in such a confusing way. I think people didn't realize what exactly they were voting for, and they messaged it as, oh, they're trying to take away our history and all that. And again, that's frustrating to me. History is, you can have history in museums. Doesn't mean you forgot it. Those statues are not up for historical reasons. Those statues are reminders that the people who fought a whole war to keep people in chains do not accept their loss. And I think that's something that, again, has really worn us down as a people, as a nation, that we did not take action to make the people who were literal traitors be treated like traitors. We let the, you know, I think it's the first time in the history of the world that the losers of a civil conflict were able to dictate the terms of how they remembered. And so I find that frustrating, not only as a Southerner, but as an African-American. You know, the one in Matthews, the statue in Matthews is built directly in front of what used to be the courthouse building. And that's a very clear message that, you know, if you come here for redress of grievances, you'll find yourself wanting, because this is what we think of you. And so, you know, it's funny, in my hometown, I had a gentleman that I knew, a white gentleman, who was like, you know, I don't know why y'all are getting all upset about that statue now. I never heard about it when I was a kid. And I wanted to turn to him, like, when you were a kid, people were being lynched. You know, you're 68. When you were a child, speaking out against the statue could get you shot in the face. And so I definitely write about that, you know, in my work, not just all the centers, but all my work. I talk about race. I talk about the way that we are slowly but surely trying to understand what it means to be Southern in the 21st century. You know, and I find that, you know, I love the South. I really do. I love where I come from. I love the place that I live. But to paraphrase James Baldwin, because I love the South, I reserve the right to criticize it because I know it can be better than what it is.
So later in the book, there's this white supremacist group led by like this wonderfully named character, Ricky Sowers. And they hold a march to protect the statue, even though it doesn't seem like there's a plan to remove it. And Titus, your hero, actually has to protect their right to march, and they're marching in Confederate uniforms. And you write like what he thinks when he looks at them. You say, he felt an atavistic revulsion roll through his body. The sight of these men, men who thought their lack of complete success in their every endeavor was proof of the falsity of their privilege and their dress grays, made him sick. And I really think that description, men who thought their lack of complete success in their every endeavor was proof of the falsity of their privilege, is really interesting. I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, so I've had debates with people I considered friends or people I knew or people I grew up with that this idea of white privilege doesn't exist. You know, there's no such thing. It's like I had a gentleman tell me, I'm working every day. You know, I'm paying bills. How is that? Where's my privilege? Where's my free car? And privilege is not free things. I think people confuse privilege with success. You know, just because you're not successful doesn't mean that you're not privileged. It's like you can be in a foot race and your mom can be the one judging the foot race and your brother can give you a 10-foot head start. And if you lose, that doesn't mean that you didn't have any privileges, you know, just mean you weren't able to take advantage of them. And so I think there's this idea among some folks that, you know, their lack of success is a proof that the privilege doesn't exist. No, your privilege is to drive down the road without getting pulled over for nothing. You know, your privilege is to go into a store and have a $20 bill that looks a little janky and the person just not accepting it. You don't end up with somebody's knee on your neck. You know, that's your privilege. Your privilege is to have an uncle, have a cousin, have a friend, have a fraternity brother who works at a bank, who gets you a good mortgage when you come in, even though maybe your credit isn't 100%. That's your privilege. Now, if you lose the house later on, that, again, it's not emblematic of not having that privilege. And so I definitely am aware of that. It's something that I've seen growing up, you know, as a kid in the South. When I was 13, I won a chess contest at our school. We had like a chess tournament. And there was a kid, I'm not going to name him, obviously, but there was a kid who didn't play chess, who didn't like chess, but he was mad that I had won. And I was on the school bus with him, and he poured some liquid on me, and we got into a fight, you know, as kids do. And you know, when the principal asked him why did he do it, he was just mad that I won the contest. He was tired of people talking about how smart I was and all that kind of stuff. And I remember turning to him and I'm like, but you don't like chess. And I, at the time as a child, I couldn't wrap my mind around that, you know. And as an adult, I realized that this particular young man was in a household where anything that wasn't whiteness centered was taken as an insult, was taken as a slight. That itself is a privilege, to believe that, to feel that. You know, I've never been ashamed of being black. I've never been ashamed of being a black man. But I'm acutely aware that my life has never been easier because of the color of my skin. Just like I have friends who are white, I doubt that their lives have ever been harder because of the color of their skin. And again, I don't want you to feel bad about that. I don't want you to, you know, genuflect and grovel about that. I just want you to acknowledge it. I think acknowledging it goes a long way to help healing some of our issues.
So you grew up in Southeast Virginia in Matthews County, a place that sounds very similar to the Charron County of your book. could you tell us about where you grew up, your family, your home?
Yeah, Oh, man. So Matthews County. It is Charon. I'll just be honest with you. I just changed the name so nobody gets mad at me. But no, I love Matthews County. Matthews County is the smallest county in Virginia. Population hovers around 8,000 people. And I know all of them. So, which made dating difficult in high school because you related to everybody. It's like, oh, I met this girl. She's your cousin. Oh, okay. Never mind. So we had to go next door to Gloucester to date. But it's a beautiful, beautiful place to live. It's right on the Chesapeake Bay. You know, there are farms there. The sea is a huge part of our lives. My dad was a waterman or a commercial fisherman when I was a kid. My grandmother worked at the seafood plant where they picked crab meat and shelled oysters and scallops. You know, my grandfather, like I said, he was an elder in our church. He was a man that I looked up to a lot. Sunday evenings, people come after church to my grandma's house, and they would just sort of casually gather there. And my grandmother would go get some hamburger meat, or she'd have some venison steaks, and somebody would cook, and then invariably somebody would find a jug of moonshine or a jar and pass that around. And I grew up around these really interesting backyard orators and these really interesting barbecue raconteurs. My uncles and my aunts told, you know, just this history of oral storytelling that I grew up around that I really love, you know. And my uncles would tell stories, and my aunts would always be would always say, "That's a lie." And my uncle Edward would say, "You know, well, if it ain't true, it ought to be." And so, and so, just this joy of telling stories, of telling jokes.
So, what were the books that your mom or other people in your family read?
I grew up in a household where people read a lot. My mom read biographies and historical novels, and she read Greek mythology. And she used to make my brother and I, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but whenever we did get some extra money, she wouldn't just give it to us in as an allowance. She would make us solve riddles. And I remember my brother was like 15. He was like, "I'm getting a job." Because
it's too much.
It's too much mental acuity going on here. But my mom read those books. My grandmother was a huge romance novel fan. So I read all these Harlequin romances.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Learned to look up words that I didn't understand. So, you know, you go right to the dictionary, like, what does "too messed" mean? And like, oh, okay. And then my aunt and my uncle respectively read horror novels and detective novels.
Yeah.
My aunt gave me my first Stephen King novel, my first Clive Barker novel. And my uncle gave me all of his John D. McDonald, Travis McGee novels. So The Deep Blue Something, and I love those stories. And I remember my aunt, when she gave me my first Stephen King novel, Salem's Lot, I was 13. And she said, "Hey, you know, you'll be able to handle this?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be fine." She said, "I don't want your mom to get mad at me." I was like, "All right." And I read the book. And then for the next 2 weeks, I slept with this popsicle crucifix that I made under my pillow because I was so afraid Ralphie Glick was coming to my window.
So, Shauna, you said something just a second ago about how in Matthews County there's 8,000 people. You know all of them. And that's kind of what it seems like in your book, that everyone knows each other. Many people are each in each other's business. And also, like, you even know, like, who all the white supremacists are. And, like, everyone drinks at this one bar, like, like all the white people, all the black people. And, you know, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of bar fights there. Is that what it was like living there?
Yeah. It is. I think it's because I think the South, in many ways, the South was forced to acknowledge their horrible past and segregation. And so in doing so, we are more accustomed to being around each other, I think, in a way that if you go to, you know, a certain neighborhood in New York, for instance, you don't have that sort of forced reclamation. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's good that we were forced to do that because I think it, you know, it helps move things along as well as things can be moving along. But yes, there's a bar here. I won't name them, but there's a local bar here that everybody ends up at. And you know, and as people are wont to do when they had a little bit too much of the libations, they have a tendency to adjudicate disagreements with their fists. And I used to be a bouncer there, so I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, I think you've actually admitted to getting a few of those fights yourself.
I am currently 3-0, so.
So when you were a bouncer, did you have like a move that you like to get someone out or of the bar or like to neutralize someone that you would have to use?
I always found And it sounds hilarious. I always found a good, especially if you're taller than someone, a good wedgie was good to get them out of the bar. Just grab them by their underpants and pull those up as high as you can. Because it disarms them. And they honestly don't know how to react. And by the time they realize what they want to do, you've gotten them outside. So that was my go-to move. I didn't want to get into a slugfest with you. I just wanted to remove you from the situation as fast as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably are never expecting that.
Not at all.
Well, Sean Cosby, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
S.A. Cosby's new crime novel is called All the Sinners Bleed. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yukundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross and Tanya Mosley, I'm Sam Brigger.